Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Karma You podcast. This is your host, Chloe Brotheridge. I'm a coach, a hypnotherapist, and I'm the author of The Anxiety Solution and Brave New Girl. And this podcast is all about helping you to become your calmest, happiest, and most confident self. Thank you so much for joining me today. I am joined by the wonderful Dr. Rupi Ojila today, aka The Doctor's Kitchen. We get into a lot of different topics in this conversation. We start off talking about the controversial aspects of talking about diet and illness. And I have really noticed, particularly on Twitter, you know, a lot of Twitter arguments going on about what you can and can't say, what is misinformation, what is truth when it comes to how much our diet and what we eat affects our health, our mental health and our physical health. And so we just dig into this, and it's something that you can tell Rupi is really passionate about. We talk about whether what we eat can actually make us happier. And I felt really inspired after what Rupi shared. I love hearing about the scientific side of things and the different studies that have been done in this area. And it really did inspire me to really look at my own diet and make some changes. And he also shares about how he looks after his own mental health and the things that he is struggling with right now and how he's overcoming those. So I hope you love this episode. Let me know on Instagram. Come on over and find me at Chloe Brotheridge. I also just want to invite you, if you haven't already, to come and visit me at my website, karmayou.com/free. I've got loads of free resources for you, hypnotherapy recordings, affirmations, worksheets, things to set you on a path for becoming your calmer self. So you can head to karmayou.com/free to grab those now. So let's get into the interview with Dr. Rupi Ojila, The Doctor's Kitchen. Thank you so much for joining me today. I can't wait to hear what you have to say today. Can you explain, maybe for people that don't know much about you and what you do, what it is that you do and how you got to where you are today?
Sure, Chloe. Well, thank you so much for inviting me along. We've met a couple of times before, just through passing, so it's good to be able to have a full-on conversation and explore ideas and stuff. So I'm Rupi. I'm a medical doctor. I've been a doctor for about 11 years now. I'm a general practitioner, but I tend to work in A&E. And I started something called The Doctor's Kitchen about 5 years ago now, where I create recipes and talk about the clinical benefits of the food and the ingredients I create, bring an evidence-based approach to eating well and feeling better in yourself. But my story sort of started over 10 years ago, actually. Just when I became a doctor, I got ill myself. So I used to suffer from something called atrial fibrillation, which is where your heart beats exceptionally fast and irregularly. And what I thought was going to be a one-off episode that occurred to me whilst I was working on shift, actually, as a 24-year-old doctor, actually was the start of continual episodes of me going up to 200 beats per minute, two or three times a week, for anywhere between 12 and 36 hours. And so that was the start of my patient journey as well as my clinical profession. And over the next couple of years, I saw multiple cardiologists, I saw lots of medical colleagues, I got loads of advice. I was going to have a procedure called an ablation, which is where you put a guide wire into your heart and then you burn an area to stop the misfiring electrical cells. And it was my mum and my family who suggested, you know, I need to look at my diet, my lifestyle, which was otherwise fine, you know, as just eating a normal quote-unquote diet with sandwiches at the canteen and cereal for breakfast or whatever. And it was me taking a methodical approach to healthy eating and actually doing a deep dive into the literature that actually led me to understand a lot more about nutrition and ultimately overcome my condition as well. And since then, I've just been having more open, honest conversations with patients. And that led to the idea of the Doctor's Kitchen probably about 8 years ago now. I didn't muster the confidence or the courage to talk about food as medicine until a lot later. So, yeah, that's kind of my story in a nutshell. And now, like, I've written a couple of books, run a podcast like yourself. I started a nonprofit called Culinary Medicine, which is where we teach right now medical students the foundations of nutrition as well as how to cook. And we're at Bristol and UCL medical schools at the moment with a view to getting this as part of everyone's compulsory medical curricula. And I'm also in the process of developing a digital platform that helps do your shopping, connects with online grocers, delivering the ingredients to your door and allowing you to cook Doctor's Kitchen meals every day, every week, with a view to supporting specific health conditions as well.
That sounds amazing. That sounds so good. You mentioned there about having the kind of the courage and confidence to talk about, you know, food in this kind of as a medical tool in a sense. Do you think that's almost like a bit of a controversial thing to talk about, because it's quite a polarized discussion? There's people on both sides. I notice a lot of people on Twitter. I know Twitter's kind of quite a savage place to hang out, and you're always going to hear the most polarized discussions, but people saying, you know, you cannot recommend someone to eat a certain way that's going to protect their immune system, or you cannot say this or that. What are your thoughts on that, and how did you find the courage to speak about these things?
Yeah, I think it's a mixture of my anecdotal experience as well as my anecdotes from clinical experience, supported with decades of research that really demonstrate the value of nutritional medicine. And I think people like to be angry for being angry's sake. There's a lot of rage across social media, and I think we've become this highly politicized community that don't really appreciate other people's views and take their own views or what they've heard as gospel, because for the sake of picking a side or choosing a community, which is innate, I think, in human behavior. When I talk about food as medicine, my understanding and my belief in this, and it's not really a belief, I think it's what it is. It is, you have to break down what medicine really entails. And medicine is the use of substances and interventions to prevent and treat ill health. If you were to regard medicine as just the prescription of medications and the performance of surgical interventions, it's a hugely naive and simplistic way of looking at what I do and what my colleagues do up and down the country every day. You know, the simple act of me having a conversation is medicine. The simple act of me encouraging someone to go for a walk every single day is medicine. And the simple act of me suggesting that someone should improve their diet is medicine, because you're changing the very foundations of our complex biochemistry that promote health and prevent illness. And that's sort of what every article, every aspect of my books has really tried to paint the picture of, to not over sensationalize food as medicine, but really bring attention to a clinical tool that has largely been ignored across my profession for decades. And I had to find out the hard way, and I think a lot of other people have had to find out the hard way. And what I believe we need to do is democratize this information and give people a lot more control and empower them to make these decisions themselves.
Totally. I'm just thinking, because I studied nutrition at university, and we were often told, you know, doctors are only given 20 minutes of nutrition information in their training. But even when I was training, I did a module about food and cancer, and that was quite a kind of controversial thing, I think. And we were often talking about, I don't know, I mean, even in sort of like healthy eating advice, there's still things like, oh, swap a normal Coke for a Diet Coke and that sort of thing. And it's, and I think it, I mean, does that miss out a lot of the scope that there is for this work, do you think?
I think it's basic, and it's under the pretense that, well, we shouldn't give people false hope because otherwise we might upset them. And I think that's wholly patronizing. And I think it's really, you know, someone said to me, you know, you might improve, if you improve your diet, your symptoms might go away. But I don't really have much evidence for that. But if you want to try it, go for it. I'd be a lot more happier with that than saying, well, I'm going to protect this person's psychology by not recommending something that may have an impact. And you know, and because I have the autonomy to do so, and I think that's the right thing to do, I think that's really, really paternalistic. And you can tell from my voice, there's not very many things that anger me, but that really does get my goat.
Yeah, okay.
I find it so patronizing. And you know, I'm completing my master's in nutritional medicine at the University of Surrey at the moment. I'm almost at the end of it, but COVID has put a spanner in the works for my project. But everything I do in the doctor's kitchen will probably come into fruition with the project anyway, so I'm kind of mixing the two. But everything I learned about during my master's course, and it's split across different modules looking at brain health, gut health, there was even topics on pediatric nutrition, etc. It's like, why wasn't I taught this? This is just not fair to at least not have the basics taught to people that in their career span will see tens of thousands of patients. And this is why I think, you know, it's less about me and everyone else giving information, but it's about encouraging a culture that encourages people to take proactive measures to look after our own health using food and every other tool that we have and all the other lifestyle features, and just make it the norm. So when I talk about food as medicine or nutritional medicine or whatever the vernacular you want to use, it's really about making it a mainstream recognizable concept that distinguishes itself from the over sensationalized charlatans out there that have used similar terminology to sell an alkaline pill or, you know, a green powder or whatever, you know, insert substance that will radically improve your health. And I think, you know, we need to talk about this in a lot more sort of open fashion. And I'll be honest, like, we in the UK are really far behind this. Like, the Americans have got culinary medicine as part of almost 50% of their medical education. 50% of medical schools have a culinary medicine program. And a lot of the research coming out of there is really looking at how we can use food as an adjunct, as a tool as well, alongside a treatment. So it's not either or, it's and. I think, you know, people who are outraged by whatever it might be just need to have a little bit of a wider perspective and, and really look toward the patient experience rather than what their interpretation of patient's experiences might be.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I think we need to distinguish between the evidence-based advice and the kind of the snake oil have this, I don't know what you use, like turmeric gummy that's going to cure your cancer or whatever it is. But I've been reading a lot about the kind of when we're anxious or scared or stressed, our brains are much more likely to think in terms of black and white, because we need to be able to make those kind of quick decisions. And yet, if we're thinking in black and white, that's not very helpful for life, because everything is nuanced and more complicated than this kind of these two binaries that we see things in. So I think, yeah, we all need just to be calmer when we're considering these things, and then we can be more rational about them anyway.
Yeah, I think we have a propensity towards binary opinions and binary behaviors. And I try and, you know, rationalize even myself, you know, the objective and the characteristic of a good scientist is someone who comes up with a hypothesis and tries to disprove it themselves. So constantly I'm encouraging myself to, instead looking at, let's say, inflammatory bowel disease, instead of looking at, okay, well, there's an autoimmune protocol, maybe that can have some benefit to a patient. The hypothesis should be an autoimmune protocol diet improves IBD symptoms over a 12-week period. Let's disprove that. Let's state, you know, that that's, you know, the negative. But unfortunately, because of a number of issues within which are distinct to the nutritional world, there isn't enough evidence to refute or prove. And so therein lies the difference in ideology and how people choose different sides. And that leaves to sort of like idealistic views of what we should be saying to patients and what we should be initially referring. I like to take a pragmatic approach. Improving your diet is most likely going to lead to benefits, as is proved across different scenarios. So even if it doesn't improve that particular aspect of your condition or your symptoms, you're most likely going to be looking after lots of other things simultaneously. So there are a lot of nuances to nutrition. As I've discovered over the last 5 years, it's one of those tricky scientific topics to navigate, particularly publicly.
Yeah, I guess it's so hard to test things on humans, because we're often not very honest about what we eat, partly because we're not even aware of what we're eating sometimes, because it's quite often on autopilot, or we're not able to be honest. So it can be, I think, hard to test, to track things accurately. If you were to say, I don't know, what advice do you give people? What can you say? What are the interesting things that do make a difference, you know, in your opinion, to our health?
Oh, I mean, I try and simplify it into principles rather than giving people like dogmatic dietary advice. And that isn't to say that a low-carb diet, a vegan diet, a paleo diet, a ketogenic diet might be appropriate and might be effective in a therapeutic way for certain people. But majority of us just need to think about principles of healthy eating. And there's eating colors, quality fats, lots of fiber, mostly plants, and eating in time as well. So it pertains to chrononutrition. And I think this is what I'm trying to do with the next book. I think, you know, I love talking about nutrigenetics and the microbiota and, you know, polyphenols and phytonutrients and all these different things that have an incredible impact on multiple different pathways in our human physiology. But I think people need more advice about how to make that habit stick, and actually how to make healthy eating just something that we all do. And so the next book I'm writing at the moment is called 3-2-1. And it's three portions of fruit and vegetables per person, two servings per recipe using one pan. So it's streamlining recipes to make it just something that we're able to do every single day. And the three portions is really what we need to aim for. When people initially heard about the Imperial College research that came out that stated we need about 800 grams of differing fruits and vegetables every single day for optimal health, it sounds wholly unrealistic because that is 10 portions of fruit and vegetables per day. And that's why I thought, well, let's break it down into different meals and actually how you're actually able to do this. And it turns out it can be quite simple if you put in place a structure that can, you know, make it easier for people to do on a daily basis. So if there was one thing I would say to people, it's don't worry about calories. Don't worry about, you know, particular macronutrient proportions. Just think about adding fruits and vegetables to your plate. And the TED talk that I did, again, for really good for beginners, is just can you add one more every mealtime? Just one more fruit, vegetable, nuts, or seeds at every mealtime. And that over the long term, the culmination of all those different habit changes and those additions to your diet can be super game-changing for a lot of people. It's certainly the way I took it when I think back to it 10 years ago when I started eating better. It was like, okay, well, I'm going to add certain things to my diet rather than just focusing on, okay, I'm going to restrict myself from something else.
Yeah, I think that's such a healthier mindset to think about what we can add rather than taking away and having principles rather than something so strict that you have to think about it so much that it becomes really unfun and you end up wanting to rebel against it anyway.
Exactly. It's because I like economics and I love entrepreneurship, I like thinking of things in terms of opportunity cost. So what is the opportunity cost of, you know, me having a load of fries, which I indulge in every now and then. So, and I try to promote that across my social media because it just gives a layer of normality to, you know, everyone's eating habits. But, you know, if you're going to be having that all the time, then the opportunity cost is that, well, you're not going to want to have your variety of different colors and vegetables and the rest of it. And so, you know, just thinking about it in that way is like, well, I'm going to have a lot of this stuff and I can have less of the other stuff. Or maybe I won't even feel like having the fries or the donuts or whatever. But it's, you know, I think you're right. I think we've put too much emphasis traditionally and historically on restriction and low fat this and low carb this. So it's, you know, more about just having what we need to eat more of that will naturally replace the other stuff.
Yeah. That sounds good. Sounds good to me. Do you think that what we eat can help us to be happier?
Yes, I can. Happiness as it pertains to mood, as it pertains to the spectrum of different mental health issues that we have. And I want to say, like, we all have mental health. We were talking about this earlier. We all have mental health issues. Some days we feel low. Sometimes we feel happy. Sometimes we undulate between those different emotions. And the degree and the spectrum by which people experience those different things is very, very wide. On one end of the scale, it's subclinical, where I feel low, I feel tired, I feel fatigued, I feel apathetic. But it doesn't disrupt my daily ability to go out and engage and, you know, speak to my family, etc. On the other end of the scale, the more extreme end of the scale, it requires pharmaceuticals, hospitalization, psychotherapy, you know, a whole bunch of suite of different issues that we need. But we are all along that spectrum. And I think once we understand that, it makes us, it's almost like what's going on right now with the pandemic. We're all in this together. We all experience this. And we can, in some ways, change ourselves along that spectrum. And I think discussing eating for mental health issues has the same complexity, and I take it with the same trepidation, as talking about food in the oncology field. Because it's highly emotive and it can, you know, spark reactions. But underlying everything that I put in is an evidence base. And underlying is, like, you know, what I really want people to appreciate. And I think if people are aware of potential tools that can help them, it will serve us better as a community. And so to answer your question, can we eat to be happy or improve our mood? Absolutely, yes, we can do. But that isn't to say that that's a silver bullet and it's, you know, negating all the other interventions that we have, like psychotherapy and engaging with people or uplifting and trying to heal past traumas, you know, but by having more long-form conversations without distractions, improving sleep, etc. But food is particularly unique in that, you know, it changes so many different variables for us. So the way I look about food, and I had to preface everything I say because I don't want to just say, oh, just, you know, eat some beans and you'll feel better. Food can impact our microbiota, this population of microbes that live in and around our body. And improving that population leads to benefits in a number of ways. The way you improve it is, like I said, principles of healthy eating. Lots of plants, lots of different fibers, color, variety, etc., quality fats. By improving that microbiota, they perform their function a lot better. And their function are as immune modulators, as balancers of inflammation, and also as producers of different types of amino acids and neurotransmitters that can impact the brain in direct and indirect mechanisms. So inflammation modulation, we used to think of our brains as immunoprotected and completely distinct from the rest of our body. We now know that that's not entirely true. Inflammation particles can cross the blood-brain barrier and cause localized inflammation that can lead to brain effects and mood disturbances. We know that our immune system is potently modulated by our gut microbiota that can be supported with all the different foods that I mentioned. And also, there's a stat, and it always swings between 60% and 90%, depending on which article you're reading, about the amount of serotonin that's produced in your gut. Long and short of it is, it's a lot, whatever that amount is. And I still haven't found someone that can direct me to where exactly that number has originated from. The serotonin in your gut that's produced along with a whole bunch of other neurotransmitters can directly impact your brain, and there are potential mechanisms behind that, but also indirectly via the autonomic nervous system, by your vagus nerve that you know, communicates with your brain by saying everything in your gut is absolutely fine, don't worry about it, and that leads to calming sensations in your brain as well that can ease mental anxiety and ease depression. And there's been some small scale research looking at the impact of diet coming out from Deakin University, I believe it was, with Professor Felice Jacka, where they actually put a small number of patients on dietary changes for about 12 weeks. And in some cases, people actually came off medications, but the vast majority of them, a significant proportion of them, actually reduced their mental health symptoms, which is, for me, absolutely incredible, because you look at the suite of different pharmaceuticals that we have and the efficacy of those is actually quite low. It isn't to say that we shouldn't be introducing them or people shouldn't be taking them, but if there are things that could potentially help, even in a small way, we need to explore that. And this whole umbrella term of nutritional psychiatry is definitely garnering a lot of interest amongst conventional, traditionally trained psychiatrists, and they're really spearheading this, you know, food as medicine movement in the US as well, which is very, very encouraging to hear about. So in the short answer to your question is yes, I think so. And I think most people, even if they don't have a diagnosis of anything, or they don't feel like they have a mental issue, will appreciate that if you eat poorly for a few days on the trot, you're not going to feel great in yourself either. And I think, you know, we've all done that. I do that every now and then. And I know, you know, it keeps me back on track, because I know exactly how I'm going to feel. Energetic, you know, cognitively aware and alert if I eat the right things.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm so glad you said that. I feel very motivated now to really improve what I'm doing. Because I think at the beginning of lockdown, I got well into cooking, and I was cooking different things every day with loads of veg, and it slightly waned. But now I feel like I feel inspired. I think, I suppose we all just want to be happy, really, at the end of the day. And knowing that by improving our diets, we can potentially, you know, improve our mental state. I think that's the most motivating thing, and would be much more motivating for me than anything else, I think. So yeah, thank you for telling me that. Yeah,
definitely. Yeah, I think, yeah, and I think lockdown it led to this huge flourish of people baking and stuff, which is great, because I think the first thing people need to learn is not necessarily like healthy eating. It's not necessarily like, oh, you have to cook in a certain way. It's just learning how to cook and becoming a lot more kitchen confident, because you can utilize those new culinary skills and apply it to whatever way of eating that you want. And, you know, obviously I'd want to encourage people to eat well, but you know, I actually love seeing people making banana bread and, you know, sourdough and all this stuff. It's great. It's great to see. And hopefully coming out of this lockdown period, we can encourage a more proactive population that are more in tune with self-care, because we know what the important things are. It's our families, it's connection, it's food, and it's happiness. It's just the joy of being with people.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think it's interesting. Yeah, I think it is so much about confidence when it comes to cooking, just believing that you can. Sometimes I find myself doing this. I feel like I don't believe I'll be able to follow a recipe or something. And then I do it and I'm like, yes, actually I can. Like, I need to remember this.
Yeah, exactly.
I was really interested to hear about what you do personally to support your own mental health.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I've got a puppy now.
Best thing ever.
Which is the best thing ever, yeah. He's fallen asleep right next to me. She's so, so cute. What do I do mentally? Well, I'll tell you a few things I've picked up in the last year. Apart from eating well, and like, I think I have a super healthy diet generally. Like, I'm that person that will, you know, go to a restaurant and purposely order a couple of the sides of asparagus or spinach or whatever, just to supplement my meal, because I almost crave quality greens and healthy additions to my plate of food or my mealtime whenever I'm eating. So I think I've got that on lockdown. A couple of things I do to improve my mental health are I have some coffee free days, because I know excess coffee actually makes me a bit anxious and gives me a bit of a crash. I'm quite sensitive to caffeine, he says as he drinks the coffee. So I have caffeine free days that improve the tolerability and actually mitigate it against poor sleep. So I definitely do that. The other thing I do, and I'm definitely making more of an effort with, is my sleep. So my sleep, I wear an Oura ring to track my sleep, and I have done for like the last couple of years now. It's incredible the insights it can give you. Wearables are not for everyone, because I think it can, again, almost on par with calorie counting, it can get a little bit overwhelming for people. But for me, I find it exceptionally motivating. And it's that gamification of my sleep that's actually kept me on the straight and narrow. So I try and improve my sleep using tracking technology. And the other thing I do is breath work and meditation. I don't do it enough. I definitely, like this morning I was meant to do it. I got distracted with a puppy. I had this podcast to do. I didn't have time to do it. I should do it later on, actually. I might do it after we're finished. But yeah, I find that super calming. It improves my heart rate variability and improves my general heart rate. And I always feel very refreshed when I do a streak of those over a couple of weeks. So those are different things that I try and encourage. And the fourth thing, the wild card, is social media fasting. Trying not to look at the news, trying not to follow toxic people, trying not to engage in debate. I'm very good at not engaging in debates online. I generally, you know, even if someone says a snarky comment or anything like that, I thank them, I appreciate them, and I let it go. And I think that whole process of letting go, even in a simple way as not replying to a comment or applying in a very civilized, overly kind way is something that hopefully trickles down into my general life and how I react. I think I've definitely become a little bit calmer in that respect, in terms of my reaction to things that annoy me.
Yeah, that's such a good thing to do, I think, because it can be so easy, I think, when you get criticized or you get someone just being unreasonable, to kind of go into an emotional response. But actually that can just make you feel worse, or it can escalate things. And actually the best thing to do is just take the higher ground and reply really nicely and then just let it go. Best for everyone involved, I think. Yeah,
I think it's
good to hear you doing that.
You're right. It's part of like that meditation practice. It's like recognizing how you feel in that moment, and accepting it and then letting it go. And it sounds very simple to do. In reality, it's exceptionally hard, particularly when, and you know, this happened on a number of different occasions where someone insults or questions your professional authority. Someone questions your life's work, essentially. Someone questions something you've been practicing day in, day out for 15 years. And when your inner and your self-identity, your core has been antagonized or criticized, it's very obvious and very acceptable and understandable to feel some anger, some feel some rage, feel hurt, feel vulnerable, embarrassed, etc. But the practice, and this is, sorry to go on a tangent here, but the practice that I'm trying to entertain on a daily basis is understand that, and you're allowed to feel that. That's absolutely fine. It's okay to feel that, but then just let it go. Recognize the rage, recognize the anger, and then let it go as fast as you can. And hopefully that comes out in, you know, social interactions thereafter as well, in any context.
Yeah, and I'm sure that's relevant for people listening as well. I think particularly now, I'm sure other, I don't know, it's, I know everyone's Facebook feed is obviously different, but mine is extremely polarized with all sorts of things about conspiracies and vaccines and vegans and non-vegans and this and that. And it's like quite an overwhelming place. And if you have a certain view, then there's going to be people that disagree with you if you're one of these polar opinions. So try not to get kind of caught up in it, and trying to be kind in the way that you're responding rather than unkind, because it's just healthier
totally.
For everyone.
Totally. Because I mean, social media is designed to reflect the weaknesses, I would say, in human behavior and human psychology. It's already hacking our innate desire to, you know, act in rage or whatever. And your currency in today's day and age is your like, your share, your comment. And I think where you choose to spend that will dictate the landscape and the virtual environment, but also your physical environment going forward. And so what I like to remind people of is the toxicity that you engage in, whether it's the president of a particular country or whether it's someone you disagree with because of your idea about what people should be eating, fuels a negative landscape that I think we should be more aware of and we should take more control of. It's very easy for me to say this and dictate to people what they should be doing. It's up to them at the end of the day. But I think people need to be a little bit more aware of just, you know, how easy it is to antagonize each other and why we are being willingly pushed in that direction, because that's how social media algorithms are built. It's, you know, this is why, because it basically rewards that kind of behavior.
Gosh, this is so interesting.
Yeah, I mean, if I went on a rant, let's say, if I was to go on my social media and I was to rant about conspiracies about pandemic, or, you know, these anti-vaxxers need to get off their high horse or anything like this, I'm sure it would generate so many comments, both positive and negative, so many likes. But and if I am of that person, that mindset, it's like all I need to do is just try and get more and more likes, more and more followers, more and more. Because again, that's been sold to us as this idea that is a desirable, and that's what we should attain. Then yeah, of course, that's exactly the game that I would be playing. Fortunately, I feel like I've got a little bit more insight than because of my time being on this platform for so long, to not engage in that kind of behavior, because I don't think it's good for anyone. And the whole purpose and the whole reason why I started this project is to help people live healthy, happier lives. And I don't think that's going to be particularly helpful.
yeah, totally. And I often think, I don't know, people like Katie Hopkins, I think that's what her name is, not a very nice person, to put it mildly, but I sometimes think, is she just being so divisive because that's why she has a job? She has a
that's
job
exactly
because she's
why.
So extreme. She can't be that despicable really inside, can she? I mean, maybe
no,
she can.
No, she's not.
She's playing,
no.
Hamming it up.
Yeah, exactly. And like, you know, I don't particularly like anything she puts out. I don't follow her. I don't comment on her. I don't like it. I don't dislike it. It's just like the people who play the game properly are now in positions of power, and we sit around asking ourselves how on earth that was allowed to happen. Well, the reason why it was allowed to happen is because you engaged in it, and you added fire to the, you added fuel to the fire. The reason why there are certain people who are on pedestals, like the person you mentioned, like presidents of certain countries, etc., is because we have given them that we've spent our currency on them, and that currency is our attention, it's our comments, it's honestly, this is why. And so when people realize that, hopefully we can exercise some restraint, because that's essentially what is going on in today's day and age. We have to wake up and realize that our reality is it's a lot more fragile, and it's a lot more moldable with our engagements. And the importance of it as well.
I think we do need to be careful where we put our attention. I study Qigong, and there's a saying, a Chinese saying, Yi Dao Qi Dao, where you put your mind, you put your energy.
100%.
So don't 100%. Put our energy on the crap stuff, basically. Yeah.
I love that. Where you put your mind, you put your energy.
I think it might actually be where the mind goes, energy follows. Where the mind goes, energy follows. That sounds better.
Where the mind goes, energy follows. It's totally right. It reminds me of a Bruce Lee comment or a quote. He must have got it from some of those ancient teachings as well. About, you know, your energy flows. You have a lot more control of your energy if you – I'm going to bastardize this comment, so I'm not going to repeat it. But like, so I think it's in that kind of vein. And I totally believe that. I totally believe that. Yeah, I was having a conversation with someone the other day, actually, who's a sports psychologist. He's worked with Premiership footballers and all the rest of it. And he told me, you know, one of the most important things people need to realize is that external factors can't change your psychology. External factors can't change your psychology. You change your psychology. You change your mindset. So if something angers you, you have the choice to let it anger you or not let it anger you. And you are that filtration. You are that barrier right there. And the more control we have over our internal reactions, we shape our external environment. And I think, again, like I said, it's easier said than done, but I think that's quite eye-opening, and it's definitely been eye-opening for me, and it's definitely been something that I've tried to put into practice more of.
So interesting. I wanted to ask you as well, is there anything that you are struggling with at the moment, and how are you kind of handling that or overcoming that at the moment?
I'm struggling with my puppy at the moment. But that side,
I heard puppies are harder than babies to look after in the beginning. They need more attention.
I've never looked after a baby, but I mean, she definitely needs a lot of attention. She's super cute though. She's just sleeping there. What am I struggling with? I would say over the last few weeks, I've been a lot more irritable with lockdown and with the situation. I've actually realized I'm actually quite introverted. Like I actually, in a weird sadistic way, I quite like to lock down. The reason why is because I tend not to go out the weekends anymore. I tend to like being inside and working on my computer and yada yada. And the knowledge that no one else is doing anything allowed me not to have that much FOMO. And actually, I found that quite settling. But I think that speaks to one of the things that I am struggling with, and it's working too much. I usually pre-lockdown like have a general guide with myself. It's like not to work after 6 p.m. and forget about work afterwards. But because of my increased clinical pressures, because I was writing this third book at the same time as finishing off my master's, as trying to start this digital product, a lot of things were getting on top of me. And I thought the way out of that was to work my way through it. And that has led to, you know, disagreements with people I love and you know, issues or, you know, around like attention, all that kind of stuff. And I think the reason why is it all comes down to me is because I haven't been as self-disciplined. So I think that's definitely something I've been struggling with over the past couple of months. But it ebbs and flows. You know, other times I've struggled with mindset, motivation. I generally keep to a healthy lifestyle. So I think it's that deeper psychology stuff. Whereas I guess for a lot of other people, you know, it's habit formation. It's making sure that they're keeping their physical bodies well with an idea of, you know, getting around to the root of how their psychology improves as well. So, yeah, I think those are the things that I'm struggling with at the moment, but I'm getting there.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I think I'm sure lots of people can relate to that in terms of introverts being kind of glad that they don't have to go out. And yet maybe that can, if we're at home, and especially if we work for ourselves, or we, I suppose everyone, not most everyone is working at home, then there's no off point. You don't kind of have a 5:30 p.m. or 6 p.m. kind of go home and end the day. It's much more fluid. So work can just continue off into the evening. And I think, we need to, often our body shows us when we're overworking. I know mine does. My body starts to like seize up if I'm overworking, and it tells me, right, you've got to slow down a bit.
I'll tell you, there's something else that I'm struggling with, Chloe, and this study was recently brought to attention, to my attention, is that I think I risk being overly optimistic and overly positive about things, when actually I need to accept reality and just say to myself, things are pretty shit right now. And, you know, to appreciate that not everyone can have that eternal optimism that I seem to appear to have, at least on the external aspect anyway, and to let that sit with me. Because I think, I practice gratitude. I'm a very positive-minded person anyway. And I think that's just because of my upbringing, because of my position in work. I know how worse things can be for other people. But I think sometimes if you constantly portray a positive image on what is a less than desirable situation, you risk trying to cloud it and sugarcoat your situation for the sake of being positive, rather than just letting it wash over you and accept it. And I think that's something I need to work on going forward as well. That isn't to say that, you know, we shouldn't have a positive mindset. I think, you know, there's a balance to strike there. I mean, everything always comes down to balance and homeostasis and equilibrium. And this is why I'm fascinated by those ancient concepts of, you know, just the middle way, the middle path, not being happy, not being sad, just being in the ebb and flow, and, you know, accepting that everything changes. Happy moments change to sad moments change to happy moments, etc. Everything ebbs and flows with the transition of life.
Yeah, I think, I suppose, accepting the quote unquote negative feelings helps us to process them, I know from lots of people that I speak to that there can be this pressure to be positive, yeah. and everything is a positive meme on Instagram and, yeah. you know, hashtag positive vibes, and we don't allow ourselves to feel things, or we stay so busy that we block out the negative feelings. And actually just giving ourselves permission to feel them and let them move through means that a better experience overall, because that stuff will come up to bite us if we suppress it. But
yeah, yeah. exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You're right. It's like that. I don't feel like I suppress things, if I'm honest, but I think I'm at risk of doing that by constantly portraying a positive perspective on things. I'm at risk of suppressing true feelings and instead accepting, you know, this is pretty crap right now, and then, you know, working through that rather than not acknowledging that the situation is less than desirable.
Yeah, yeah. I think that the answer to everything is it's complicated. So yes, yeah. it's always complicated. It's always shades of grey. It's always, there's always nuance. So let's be open-minded to things. Yeah. thank you so much for everything you've shared. I've loved this conversation. Where can people find out more about you? When is your new book out? And yeah, what else are you offering?
Sure, yeah. So my new book's not out for a while. you can pre-order it on Amazon, but it's not out until January 2021. And the book's going to be called Doctor's Kitchen 321, three portions of fruit and vegetables per portion, two servings per recipe using one pan. So curries, stews, casseroles, tray bakes. It's basically just streamlining the whole process. So it makes healthy eating a habit and just something that we do every day. And thedoctorskitchen.com is really where people can find out about stuff. We publish two brand new recipes on the newsletter every single week. The podcast is all linked there. We interview people talking largely about nutrition and nutritional medicine in certain disciplines. So eating for your brain, eating for your heart, eating for your mood. And I'm also, you know, founder of the nonprofit Culinary Medicine, which is really trying to revolutionize how we teach nutrition to healthcare professionals. Initially, right now, it's medical students and doctors, but we are hoping to go and explore into allied health professionals, nursing professionals, just seeing where that takes us, really. We've got loads of really big plans for that. But the whole ethos and the whole, like, mission is to try and help 10 million people eat Doctor's Kitchen meals every day. It's a really ambitious task, but I think, you know, it's definitely something that is achievable and something that I'm trying to visualize and create like a distinct and crystal idea of what that looks like. And I think hopefully from everything I've read anyway, that will help it to fruition into reality. So yeah, but I've really enjoyed this conversation, Chloe. This has been, it's kind of cathartic for me, actually. So it's quite nice to talk about it.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you so much. You have been listening to the Karma You podcast with me, Chloe Brotheridge. Don't forget, you can download loads of freebies for anxiety and confidence at my website, karmayou.com. You can also find out about my app and my one-on-one sessions. Please do subscribe to this podcast in the Apple Podcast app. And if you have enjoyed it or found it helpful, please leave me a review. It makes a massive difference to helping the podcast get discovered by other people. And come on over and find me on Instagram. I'm hanging out there every day. You can find me at Chloe Brotheridge. Let me know what you thought of this episode. And please do share it with anyone who might need to hear this today. So I'm sending you loads of love and I hope you have a brilliant week ahead.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.